volunteers of... Can you turn it up a little bit? Or... Good afternoon. Welcome to this session on the new frontiers in harm reduction. We've got an excellent panel of harm reduction experts this afternoon. I'm Jerry Stimson, one of the co-chairs, and my co-chair is Daniel Zulaika, who is president of the Spanish AIDS Society and a harm reduction fan and founder of many harm reduction activities in Spain. I'd like to thank Marcus Day here, who put the session together, help us choose the experts today. I'm not going to say much more because you want to hear the speakers and we want to have time for questions at the end. We'll wait until all the speakers have spoken before we have questions. And I would like short questions, please. No speeches and no advertisements. Just bear in mind that the longer you speak, the less other people can. So there's a bit of democracy at work here. So short, sharp questions. Our speakers have 12 minutes each, and they will also be sharp and to the point, and they will be keeping their eye on the green, yellow, and red lights. So I'd like to hand over to my co-chair to introduce the first speaker.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce the first speaker, Rick Lines from the United Kingdom. He is going to talk about harm reduction and human rights. Rick has been working in HIV/AIDS and harm reduction policy and advocacy for more than 10 years, and he is recognized internationally for his work on HIV and harm reduction in prisons. Rick, please.
Thank you very much. Yes, my name is Rick Lines, and I work for the International Harm Reduction Association based in London. I'm the senior policy advisor at IHRA, and I lead our HR2 team, which is our harm reduction and human rights program. And I'm going to speak to you today on the topic of giving human rights lifeblood, advocating for a right to harm reduction in international human rights law. Now, as we've heard, the theme of today's session is new frontiers in harm reduction, and I don't want to suggest for one second that the use of human rights discourse or human rights language within harm reduction advocacy is something new. Harm reduction has always had principles of social justice and human rights as one of its core principles, and therefore harm reduction advocates have traditionally used human rights language as part of our advocacy campaigns. But that said, there are a number of areas of human rights that we haven't actually accessed to the degree that we might in terms of influencing policy change on the national and international level. And one of those is in the use of international human rights law. And I want to stress at the beginning that when we talk about human rights, we're not strictly talking about lofty principles and aspirational targets or slogans that we put on banners. We're also talking about a codified system of international law, one that is based upon multi-party international treaties and form the foundation of international human rights law. For the purposes of my presentation today, I'm going to be focusing on the UN human rights system, which is composed of 8 core human rights treaties that have been negotiated at the international level. I should emphasize that just because these are international treaties does not mean that these are standards imposed upon countries from the outside. Just the opposite. Countries choose voluntarily to participate in human rights treaties. In the same way a country would ratify a trade agreement or an arms control agreement, countries choose through their own autonomous political processes whether to ratify and therefore be bound by the terms of a human rights treaty. But once they do decide to ratify and pass that treaty, they are bound. They are agreeing to respect, protect, and fulfill the rights enshrined in that treaty. And they're also agreeing to participate with the systems of human rights monitoring that go along with that treaty. And in all of the UN human rights treaties, there are independent, what we call treaty bodies. These are independent committees of experts whose job it is, on the one hand, to monitor state compliance with human rights obligations, and the other is to sort of assess and interpret the meaning of the treaties themselves. And the workings of these treaty bodies are very, very open and friendly to civil society organizations, and they provide a real mechanism for harm reduction advocates, which to date we haven't utilized to the degree that we should. Of course, one of the rights enshrined in international law is the right to health. It's a right that we find enshrined in a number of treaties, but typically when we talk about the right to health, we're talking about Article 12 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which states in part that everyone has the right to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. But it also stipulates that states have the responsibility to take steps to prevent, treat, and control epidemic and other diseases. So we can see within this broad concept of the right to health, harm reduction fits very neatly, whether that's around protecting and promoting the rights of individual people who use drugs, or indeed taking steps to promote broader community health and prevent disease transmission. This makes Article 12 a particularly useful tool for promoting harm reduction. In particular, because it is a human rights treaty that's been ratified by 159 countries around the world. 159 countries have signed up to promoting rights, including the right to the highest attainable standard of health. These 159 countries parallel quite neatly the 158 countries that up until 2008 have reported injecting drug use in their population. But despite the large number of ratifications of this treaty, despite the large number of countries reporting injecting drug use in their populations, we see that the harm reduction scale-up is significantly lacking. Only 77 countries to date have provided needle exchange in some form, and fewer countries, only 63, provide substitution treatment of some kind. So this gap between the rights as expressed in the International Covenant and the actual realization of HIV prevention programs for injecting drug users on the ground really begs the question that we ask in our office all the time, half humorously and half seriously, to focus our minds, which is, I have the right to health, so what? What does having the right to health mean if I can't actually exercise that right? What does having the right to health mean if I'm not able to access the health-based tools I need to promote and protect my right? Is harm reduction itself even part of the right to health? I think you'll find many states who would argue that it's not. You'd find many states who would say they are promoting the right to health by actually applying drug-free and punitive drug enforcement policies and trying to promote drug-free societies. And they would argue that they are doing that in consistency with their obligations under international narcotics control treaties. So this really illustrates part of the challenge for us as HIV activists, as harm reduction activists, as human rights activists, is moving through the various levels of human rights. Human rights exist on at least three different levels. We have rights as they're declared, rights on the books, such as the right to the highest attainable standard of health, as it's written in a treaty. We have rights as they're interpreted. What does that actually mean? How do courts interpret those rights? How do treaty bodies and monitoring bodies interpret those rights? And then most importantly, there are rights as they're experienced by people in their everyday lives, the degree to which people are actually able to access and live and utilize those rights. So I think part of the challenge for us is actually moving through those phases to actually take the rights that exist on paper and actually put them in a form that people can actually utilize them and realize them in their everyday lives. So for ourselves in our project at IRA, at HR2, one of the challenges that we're trying to pursue is to establish harm reduction as an explicit component element of the right to health under international human rights law, and to try to build international case law that supports that. Now, what would this mean for advocates? I think there's a number of advantages this would provide for us as an advocacy tool. First and foremost, it would mean that the provision of harm reduction is not merely a policy option available to states, but is a fundamental element of fulfilling obligations in international law. At the same time, it would also mean that the failure to provide harm reduction would constitute a violation of international law. So these could be very powerful advocacy tools and messages that we can use in our advocacy initiatives. On a broader level, defining a right to harm reduction might provide an opportunity to engage some of the broader human rights movement in drug policy and harm reduction issues, because with a few notable exceptions, Human Rights Watch being one of them, most of the mainstream broader human rights movement has really shied away from talking about drugs in their work. And in terms of our work at IRA, one of the advantages of enshrining this right to harm reduction means that it would allow us the opportunity to engage the human rights elements of the United Nations to exert influence on the drug control mechanisms within the UN. So what do I mean by that? When we think about harm reduction at the UN level, one of the biggest barriers that we've seen over time at the international level has been the drug control regime of the United Nations. This is a regime that's underpinned by three core international narcotics control treaties and three UN bodies that oversee narcotics control. These bodies have historically been quite antagonistic towards harm reduction, although UNODC has changed its tune a little bit in recent months. And there's been a lot of advocacy that's focused on trying to influence these three drug control bodies within the UN. But I think when we take a step back and look at human rights as an opportunity to advocate for harm reduction in the UN, we see that these three narcotics control bodies, rather than being the center of the UN universe, are really sort of a peripheral player in the broader UN structure. The Commission on Narcotic Drugs, for example, is only a subcommittee. It's a functional commission of the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. ECOSOC reports to the General Assembly. We also have the Human Rights Council, which is a very senior and new body, which reports to the General Assembly. We have the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. We have the Special Procedures, which are the UN Special Rapporteurs, UN independent experts on various rights, including the right to health. And we also have those independent treaty bodies that monitor the conventions. All of these have a human rights mandate, a human rights focus. And if we can actually involve these organizations in harm reduction issues and drug control issues and impress upon them that harm reduction is a component element of the right to health, one of the things it does, it allows us to bring all of those much broader UN systems into bear in influencing and putting pressure on the drug control regime. And this is not least of importance is because under international law, as defined in the UN Charter, human rights takes precedence over drug control. And I won't go into the details about that now because we can have questions about it if we like. So this is sort of our strategic approach to try to influence the international narcotics control regime and through that process create policy space to expand harm reduction and support for harm reduction. So just briefly to wrap up, some examples of some of the activities that we've been involved in at the UN level, and these are just a few examples, and I would certainly encourage all the organizations here to emulate some of these, take them up yourselves, and think of new ones that we can learn from. One is that we're doing a shadow report in collaboration with the Swedish Drug Users Union to the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. This is the committee that monitors the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. We've done a joint submission to that body arguing that Sweden's failure to provide harm reduction measures is in violation of Sweden's obligations under the right to health, a very important initiative being led by a drug user organization at the UN. We've had very high-level engagements both with the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, working in partnership with Human Rights Watch, specifically on the issue of the death penalty for drugs. And part of our objective there is to try to get UNODC to implement a system of human rights assessments as part of all their law enforcement technical assistance to ensure that law enforcement practices do not result in an unintended way in either death penalty or in other types of human rights abuses by law enforcement. We've engaged with very many of the special rapporteurs, the special rapporteur on the right to health, Anand Grover, who's just been appointed, who's here at the conference this week, the special rapporteur on torture, the special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, all of which have a mandate that can impinge and reach into various areas of abusive drug enforcement or human rights. In September, we'll be doing a side event at the Human Rights Council in Geneva in collaboration with Human Rights Watch, IHRD, and the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network, doing a side event focusing on harm reduction within the context of the right to health and trying to put harm reduction on the radar screen of the UN Human Rights Council. And we also don't ignore the importance of the UN Commission on Narcotics Drugs. A lot of us were there this past March. IRA was instrumental in drafting the first ever human rights resolution that was put through the Commission on Narcotics Drugs by a group of friendly countries. And we also organized the collaborative side event at that event, again with our partners Human Rights Watch, Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network, and the International Drug Policy Consortium, focusing on human rights abuses as a result of drug enforcement activities. And I'll just close. The title of my presentation, as I said, is Giving Rights Life's Blood, and that's a quote that I take from the speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King, and I think this really epitomizes the challenge ahead of us for all of us working in HIV and human rights and in harm reduction. Dr. King said that legislation and court orders can only declare rights. They can never thoroughly deliver them. It's only when people themselves begin to act are rights on paper given life's blood. And I think that's getting back to that point I said before. It's our collective efforts that are needed to actually ensure that those rights that are declared in these very high-principled international documents are actually exercised and realized by people living everyday lives in the street. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Caitlin Paget, who is one of the coordinators of Youth Rise, which is the new youth harm reduction network. She is a committed, enthusiastic, and tireless youth activist who's been... I know you wrote tired youth activist, but I changed it to tireless. Who's been working on youth issues for the last 8 years. She is tireless and also a little bit tired like the rest of us. She's also co-chair of the Youth Pavilion. Over to you, Caitlin.
Hi. So yeah, part of my role here at the conference is as co-chair of the Youth Pavilion, which is why I'm especially tired right now, and I'm losing my voice, so bear with me. Hopefully you can hear me okay. So I didn't come up with any sort of creative title for my presentation. I guess I was, I don't know, busy doing other things. But I'm going to be talking about Youth Rise and youth engagement in harm reduction. So hopefully what I hope to do is be able to give you a little bit of insight into Youth Rise and what we're trying to accomplish with this program, and then also talk about some of the issues that we feel are really pertinent to this conference, because I realize that not all of you are harm reduction activists or interested in harm reduction policy, and maybe some of you work in sexual and reproductive health. So just to be able to highlight some of... Yeah, this is still flashing with Rick's time. Okay, it's good now. Thank you. I also just want to acknowledge my co-coordinator from Youth Rise, who's sitting in the front row right there. It's Kyla. So I don't coordinate this network on my own. We co-coordinate it. And I'm up here talking, but I wouldn't be here without her work and her support, and she helped me work on this presentation. So I just wanted to acknowledge her. So basically, Youth Rise started in 2006. That's when we officially launched the network at the Vancouver International, the International Harm Reduction Conference in Vancouver. And the reason why we decided to launch an international youth network for harm reduction is because, as a young person, showing up at my first ever international conference in Belfast the year before, I felt extremely underrepresented and quite alone. Actually, it was a bit of a lonely experience for me. And I went to a panel on young people that was sponsored by UNICEF, and all of the presenters were older people. And it was really difficult to sort of see where young people actually meaningfully fit into the movement. And so, fortunately, the timing worked out. There was some interest. Some other young people involved, some key supporters and mentors involved. We formed a small working group and were able to launch a network in 2006, although we didn't actually receive funding until just this past November. We're working right now in partnership with IRA, and our funding comes from the Department for International Development, just a little seed funding for us to get going. We're still looking for more partnerships and more funding, so if you have any ideas, please let us know, because we're very under-resourced at this point. Some of our other key partnerships that I just really want to mention are the World AIDS Campaign. They helped us put together this resource on young people and injecting drug use and HIV, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without their support, as well as UNICEF supporting youth participation into the International Harm Reduction Conferences and the Global Youth Coalition on HIV and AIDS. Right now, we're the only international youth network working on harm reduction issues. And so the past 6 months since we've been working on this full time have been extremely busy. And I'm going to illustrate some of the issues that we're working on in a minute. We also decided to work with a model. It was really important for us to be truly representative of international youth. And we realize that young people in different areas around the world are struggling with a lot of different issues when it comes to substance use. So we have a working group of 13 young people from 9 regions around the world. We have a few extra people from regions such as Eastern Europe and Asia. And we are kind of underrepresented maybe in some areas. We only have one member from sub-Saharan Africa and one from North Africa and the Middle Eastern region, and one person from Latin America, one person from the Caribbean. So we try to be as inclusive as possible. And this working group provides our direction, tells us what we should focus on, and is involved in many different ways in our organizing. Some of the key areas we're focusing on is advocacy, research, and training. We want to be able to make sure that young people's issues are on the table and they're included in the discussions around harm reduction and harm reduction policy. We want to be able to up the amount of research about young people, young people's issues with related to substance use and drug policy and harm reduction. And we also want to be able to create some training resources that young people around the world can use if they're interested in harm reduction, or people who are working with young people as well. So those are some of the key areas that we're focusing on. This is a picture of some of our working group members. We had the opportunity to meet in Barcelona at the International Harm Reduction Conference there. So these are some of our members. So I guess in a way we are a new frontier. It sounds kind of cheesy, but it's true. I don't think that young people have really been represented in the harm reduction movement at all up until very recently, and we're really trying to change that. When we talk about young people with our network, we're talking about ages 15 to 24. That's UNICEF's definition of young people, and as a group we decided to work with that age definition. But we also acknowledge that young people under the age of 15 are also dealing with some of the same issues, particularly street children and street youth. So we're not really bound to this, but that's sort of our working definition of young people. And we have a special concern for young people under the age of 18, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. We're also working within a youth engagement model, so basically the model that young people have a right to be included in the decisions that affect their lives. That's a big goal of ours. So we want to be at the table when there's decisions being made, when there's policies being created that affect young people. And as we know, young people make up the largest proportion of drug users around the world, if we're talking people under the age of 25. And so we have a right to be included and at the table in an equal partnership. I think also we're redefining harm reduction. A lot of times the harm reduction movement is focused around injection drug use, focused around substitution therapy, focused around older drug users, and that's sort of been the history of the global movement anyways. And we're really trying to redefine that, saying that harm reduction works for young people, it just might look a little bit different. And also, user organizing looks different. We define ourselves as users differently. Some of our members define themselves as users, some don't, some are interested in policy, some aren't. But our lives are different. We have different needs. We have different things that we're interested in. And so I think that that's some of the new energy that we're bringing into the harm reduction movement as well. We're also challenging the controversy. Harm reduction has been really controversial when it comes to young people. People are really resistant to the idea, the result of that has been that there's a lot of money into prevention and nothing else, really. So there's prevention education, there's abstinence-based programs for young people, but once young people start using, there's often not a lot for them. In some countries, if we're lucky, there's treatment. In other places, that treatment means detention or being locked up or forced treatment or nothing. So we're really saying that prevention is part of the continuum, but there's a lot of young people out there that need more than prevention messages. They need real, honest information. They need resources. They need access to services that meet them where they're at. I think, too, there's a special controversy that comes in. You know, our friends in the sexual and reproductive health rights movement face it when talking about sex and young people. Then you add drugs into that, so it's sex and drugs. Then you add minors into that, and it's an uncomfortable topic for a lot of people. A lot of adults don't really want to think about young people, particularly their children or their friends' children, having sex, doing drugs, especially if they're underage. But the reality is that young people are, and we have to do something about that, and that's what we're trying to address. So I'm going to focus a little bit around HIV and transmission of HIV through injection drug use right now. One of our big concerns is that young people under the age of 18 in most places around the world cannot access harm reduction services even where they do exist. So a lot of needle exchange programs where there are needle exchange programs have age restrictions that restrict young people from accessing those services. And to me, that's criminal. We're denying young people the right to a health service because of their age. I'm going to talk a little bit about what some special recommendations are around underage youth, but this is an issue that's not being talked about, and I don't understand why. It's not being talked about really in the harm reduction community, and it's not really being talked about in the youth community because the youth activists around HIV aren't really looking at injection drug use because injection drug users aren't represented. Young people who use injection drugs are incredibly marginalized, often street involved, maybe sex workers, don't get to come to venues like this, don't get to speak for themselves, and aren't represented, aren't showing up at services for lots of different reasons, and as such, policies aren't changing. And to me, this is unacceptable. So this is so this is a big issue for us and something we hope to keep working on. We also know that young people in many regions are initiating injection drug use a lot earlier, and that the distance between other ways of using drugs and injection is growing smaller. So this is a big concern as well. We also have a particular concern for young women, and in particular young women who are injection drug users, and we don't feel like there's enough attention paid to some of the gender-related issues. And like I mentioned, youth services versus harm reduction services. Harm reduction people don't want to work with youth or are uncomfortable working with youth or it contradicts their policies or they don't know what to do. Youth services don't want to work with drug users. So we have this huge gap in services for young people who are using drugs, particularly injection drugs, and this is something that has to change. So just some examples. This information comes from the Eurasian Harm Reduction Network and UNICEF. So just to give some examples in some of these areas, the average age of initiation into injection drug use is 16, 15 to 18, 13 to 18, or 15. But people aren't accessing services until they're over 20 years old. So what happens to those young people in between 13 or 15 and 18 and 20 and 21 and 22? So this is an example of where the disconnect is between services and what age people are when they can access them. And also the fact that a lot of these services aren't youth-friendly. So even where there are services and harm reduction services, young people may not feel safe or comfortable accessing them. They may not identify with older users. They may not think about themselves as problematic users. They might not want to be around older users. They might feel vulnerable or in positions where they might be exploited. So that's why we need youth-friendly harm reduction services. I'm quoting myself here. This is something I wrote in an email and had somebody sort of said, well, that's a really good way of summing it up. I think the way a lot of harm reduction services, particularly for injection drug users, work now is they sort of tell young people, wait until you're older, sicker, and more worse off. Then we can serve you. We can't serve you when you're 13 or 15. Come back later when you're worse off. And again, this is unacceptable. We have to really pay attention to young users, where there are young users, and find creative, innovative, effective, supportive, reality-based services for them. So let's work together and do that. That's part of what our network is trying to accomplish. Here's a picture of us working hard, creating policies. Actually, not really, but... So here are some of our recommendations. We have to remove the barriers to access for young people who are under the age of 18. This is an imperative. This comes with a special care and attention, of course, to young people and their needs. We don't just want young users and adult users mixing up all the time, but it's criminal that young people cannot access harm reduction services. We're condemning them in not addressing this issue. So this is one of our key points for this conference, our advocacy points that we want to get across. We also need youth-specific policies and research. We need to prevent the initiation into injecting with young people. So that involves other kinds of harm reduction services for young people who are using other kinds of drugs, but maybe, or not injection drugs, but other ways of using drugs. So we need to have harm reduction programs for them. We need youth-specific outreach and drop-in services, safe spaces for young users to go, youth-friendly harm reduction. We need access. Access is a huge barrier. We need you to support the participation of more young people into venues like this so that they can be here and they can participate and they can speak for themselves. That's a huge, huge thing. And we also need your trust. We need you to trust that as young people that we can speak for ourselves, that as young drug users, people living on the streets, that they have a right to be included and that they have your trust and your support. I had a long quote from UNICEF. I'm almost out of time, so I'm not going to read it. But it's basically UNICEF, a report from Macedonia, saying that the legal barriers must be removed for young people to access needle exchanges and harm reduction services. And the other thing that I would encourage all of you who work in sexual and reproductive health is to really, if you're doing sexual and reproductive health work, include harm reduction. We know that there's a connection between substance use and sex. We know that sexual risk is also tied up oftentimes in alcohol and drug use. We have to be acknowledging this, and we have to be talking about this reality with young people. So please include this in your services and vice versa. And the last point, because I'm out of time, is... Rick already talked about it, but the inclusion of human rights. And for young people, that means that we have the right to the highest standard of health, including access to youth-friendly harm reduction services, needle exchanges, and substitution therapy, and that we also have the right to participation. That's our right. We need to be involved. We need to be supported. We need to be funded. We need to be trusted. And I guess I'll stop there. I look forward to your questions. And there's a human rights rally tomorrow at 1:30 in the Human Rights Zone, and I'm one of the chairs of that, and I would invite all of you to come and help link the human rights movements around HIV and substance use and harm reduction as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caitlin. I think this is the only conference where you get two sessions for the price of one. I'm sorry about the noise next door. I don't know if our technicians could speak to the people next door. The volume next door is very, very loud. Okay, thanks. Let's move on. It's a pleasure next to introduce Lanre Onigbogi, who is a public health researcher at the University College of Ibadan, Nigeria. Lanre has a strong interest in harm reduction advocacy in Africa, and he is vice president of the new Sub-Saharan African Harm Reduction Network. So over to you, Lanre.
All right, thank you. Very briefly, I will just be talking about the harm reduction movement in Africa and what we're doing. Like he introduced me, I have a background in medicine and public health, but I've recently gotten more involved with advocacy work regarding harm reduction, because I actually got to know that your work ends up on dusty tables as a researcher until you push it or you got someone to push it. So very briefly, I would try to let us see some of the contributory factors that are fueling the problems we're having in Africa and the need for us to begin to think in a new way, and then the need for us to network both in the north, south, and also within countries in the global south, and let us have an idea of what we're doing now in sub-Saharan Africa. I hope at the end of the day, just a few minutes, to give us a new lens to look at issues concerning HIV and many of the problems that we're having in the continent, and also to let us know that we must not be left behind in the harm reduction movement. There are a lot of issues that Sub-Saharan Africa is dealing with, and many of these issues are pretty obvious, but many of these issues really relate to some of the factors that are put here. Alcohol use, both licit and illicit. And in many countries, illicit alcohol production and use have actually been directly linked with sexual behavior that is irresponsible. Also, tobacco smoking. Many of us may actually be a little surprised, but a lot of research in the continent has actually shown that tobacco is actually one of the gateway drugs. It's one of the gateways into drug use in the continent. And it starts off with tobacco, and then people go up to marijuana, and then they go out to other drugs. Very few people actually start off with some of the other drugs. And then closely related to this is non-injecting drug use. And like I said, the greatest problem we have is with non-injecting drug use and associated risky behavior. But recently, there are emerging issues concerning injecting drug use. And many of these are still largely hidden, but some research in recent years have actually brought this to the fore. Now, we have enormous problems, like I said earlier, and on the continent. And so if we look away from some of these things that are contributing to the problems we have on the continent, we'll only be doing ourselves harm, because we just have to deal with them. And then many of these issues have actually worsened over time. And as you're going to see in the next slide, there's some problems we're having on the continent because there's just excess production of drugs in maybe Afghanistan or some part of Asia, and then they've actually, there are new routes that have been set up. So with greater restrictions in bringing drugs in, maybe from Latin America or some of the routes into the U.S. or into Europe, new routes have been set up. So Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa in particular, will continue to have greater problems, because when drugs come in, sometimes they don't get out, and the people just have to find market for it. Now, so why is it that we have to begin to think about harm reduction efforts? Number one, the African youth is being targeted more than ever before. And it's all because it's cool now to adopt Western lifestyles, dress the Western way. And because a lot of people actually live in the cities, that means there's just great anonymity. So you don't even know the person that's living next door to you. So you can do any kind of stuff. I mean, things that maybe our parents couldn't do 20 years ago because they were just living next to an uncle or some neighbor. As a neighbor. And that's the reason why we have to begin to think about novel things that we have to do on the subcontinent and the continent in general to address some of the emerging issues. I also talked a little about youth, but I'm really interested in youth issues because in Africa, most of the population is actually in the youth bracket. And so, more than ever before, if we have problems with drug use, overdose, the violence that comes with it, and infection will continue to get worse. Well, many of these harms can actually be reduced through simple, practical methods that we can actually develop on the continent without actually, because many people view harm reduction on the African continent with cynicism because they think it's all about opioid substitution and the fact that Europeans and Americans have produced too much methadone and they're looking for someone to sell it to. But there are things that we can do to actually work on our own continent and adopt harm reduction methods, both in drug use and in sexual health, like Caitlin had talked about earlier, to actually help to stem the tide of the HIV epidemic. The second thing we have to begin to do is to begin to think about the youth when we are adopting policies and when people are actually working out laws about drug use. Harm reduction on the continent will be beneficial to us because of the problems we're facing, like I said earlier. And the laws we have at best are either draconian, because many sub-Saharan African countries are actually coming out of military rule. I mean, like, I'm from Nigeria, and we're just like 9 years out of military rule. So a lot of thinking still comes from what people had seen. I mean, some people all their lives have not seen anything better. So they actually think you got to like push it down, your ideas, and people just got to take it. But in the real world, which Sub-Saharan Africa is coming to, because more countries are becoming more democratic and more youth are adopting new methods of living, we have to begin to think well ahead. And in thinking well ahead, we have to know that when you have laws, they just drive drug use on the ground. But when you address these issues and you're pragmatic about it, then it helps the individual, it helps the community, and it helps the countries. Now, it's actually great to work in Sub-Saharan Africa because we all share a lot of things in common, and so it's easy to communicate because one time or the other, most countries have had some kind of civil strife or are on the verge of having it. And so people can really relate at that level. And also, Sub-Saharan Africa is really fertile now because there are a whole lot of researchers who are not known internationally, but they're doing a lot of great work locally. They just pick up master's degrees and PhDs in the local universities and get a university appointment. But they're great researchers, and so they can actually be, I mean, that kind of cohort can be used. Also, civil society is getting stronger and more than ever before. If we can latch on to the movement in the civil society, we may be able to do something. Now, networking, we've really started it, but I must say more than ever before that Sub-Saharan Africa countries really have to network because there are peculiar issues in the cultural context that we only share, and many countries in the global north can never understand it because they don't share it. So we have both. We have the opportunity of harnessing individual, institutional, and governmental interest in harm reduction methods. So, like I put there, we must begin to take it more farther than just talking. We must begin to do something. So we're already doing something, and I really do hope some people here will latch onto it. Maybe Sub-Saharan African people who live in Africa or probably are from the continent will actually try to work with us in some of the things we're doing. But even if for any reason you're living now in Europe or America, but you're of African origin, you could also be of great use. So we can begin to collaborate both in the global north and south, and also in the global south. And we can begin to collaborate more than ever before with UN agencies, because there are a lot of things that are hidden about drug use and alcohol use and the HIV problems that are having on the continent. We can also, more than ever before, begin to think about individual groups. I talked about much of this earlier, but I could just briefly just talk about it, that we must take the harm reduction message more than drug use. A lot of people just think it's just drug use. But harm reduction can be adopted to problems with sex work, with the youth, with the children on and the children off the street. So we're doing a lot of work with the NGO community, and I really do hope a lot of people will get on board so that we can expand our work. I'll talk about SAN, and that's the Sub-Saharan Africa Harm Reduction Network. We have headquarters now in Mauritius, and I'm the vice president. It's just a gathering together. It's a melting pot of ideas of people who are researchers and clinicians and advocates, and we started off just sometime last year, so it's still pretty new, and we are in the teething stages. And at this level, I think this is probably the best opportunity that people have to get on board so that we can all work together. The message of harm reduction in Africa will have its desired impact if SAN can be nurtured and supported both by governments and institutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Landry. It's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Stijn Goossens, who's based in Belgium, who is a drug user activist and advocate. Stijn has worked for many years at a local level on drug user activism, and since 2004 has been involved in developing first the Drug User Congress and Satellite, and then that merged and from that evolved the international network of people who use drugs, of which he is the chief executive. So Stijn, over to you.
Thanks. Good day to all of you. It's wonderful that organizers of this year's World AIDS Conference have included so many harm reduction and drug user-related events in the program. It is also wonderful that the drug user is invited to speak at the New Frontiers of Harm Reduction sessions. Unfortunately, it's already not that wonderful that I, the drug user activist, have to speak again on Nothing About Us Without Us. Since the IRA conference in Vancouver in 2006, where VANDU, the local drug user organization, presented this first small but very true booklet, it seems that wherever there is a harm reduction event, and a drug user activist is invited to speak on Nothing About Us Without Us. Nevertheless, if we look what happens in practice, we'll see that nothing has changed that much since Vancouver. Drug users insist to be included. The professionals acknowledge that our partnership is crucially needed, but apart from some very local and very isolated examples, no real cooperation has ever been achieved. Therefore, this time, I'll not repeat again why drug users should be involved in everything about us. Apparently, either for real or for show off, everyone agrees here. Our main concern, and I mean my peers and my own main concern, is that we can ever achieve a real cooperation? I say this because the general way drug user activists are addressed and treated drives them away from drug user activism. With all my respect and admiration to everybody in this room and everybody worldwide who is striving for real harm reduction, I'll try to present truly my drug user point of view on how I feel about drug user activism, why the best of our peers lose their flame, and how to keep them involved. I mean no insult to anyone, just Nothing About Us Without Us can ever be if there are no drug user activists with experience and expertise left around. To be able to make it more clear that we really do lose our best drug user activists, and also to make it more clear why they go away, I start from the very bottom line, or from the most basic and fundamental position, which in our case, I believe, is the difference in the understanding of what is harm reduction. Let's, before speak about cooperation, agree upon who we, the activists, will cooperate with. about what and mainly where harm reduction ends and turns into something that no real drug user activist will cooperate for. I repeat once again, I mean no insult to anyone. It's not me. It's the brutal reality my peers and me are forced to accept daily. And please trust me that I have plenty of reasons to make all these statements you read behind me. Still, being a drug user, or not that trustworthy by default, I'll also give proof so everyone could have a better trust in me and in my position. If you just open the official webpage of one well-known worldwide international harm reduction association, on the most central place under the title, "What is harm reduction?" we read, "The major consequences of drug use are transmission of blood-borne diseases such as HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis B and C, overdose, various medical and psychological conditions, etc., etc." And there are more of these. Yeah. So, as I've appointed drug user activists, find these consequences and all of the other consequences included the quoted webpage to be consequences of prohibitions, not consequences of drug use. It's even not mentioned consequences of illegal drug use. From another hand, the three drug conventions, including the last one, about the drug-free world achieved by prohibition, obviously are the harm reduction measures of our society when drug users' opinion is not taken into consideration. That's why we insist nothing about us without us. That's why we also lose our best drug user activists. The difference between harm reduction and prohibition is so small that we, the user activists, after some time get confused what we work for, who we work with, and from this moment on it's very difficult for us to remain involved as activists. To make it more clear again, I'll go back to the quoted website of the same partner organization. The very same page, there are five principles of harm reduction appointed. The first is that wrong that I have to make a training to explain it. Without going too deep into the concept of harm reduction, I may say that in any case, my drug user basic needs is not to achieve abstinence in some future moment. This is neither the first principle of harm reduction nor an appropriate perception to approach and cooperate with drug user activists. Even more, such startling position will never result in effective, user-friendly, client-centered harm reduction services. Principle two of the same page is just partially wrong. It says a hierarchy of risk must be established to avoid infection from drug use, to avoid HIV infections from drug use. I say that it's partially wrong because nowhere in the whole website there's no indication that harm reduction may refer to something else apart from preventing HIV and other blood-transmitted infections. Actually, harm reduction is much more. Harm reduction is not limited to one of the consequences of prohibition. It covers all consequences and does not exclude any of the available options. Even drug-free is good enough when drug-free comes as a result of personal, voluntary decision. Anything that complies with human rights and is acknowledged by the local drug user community as helpful, as useful, as working is harm reduction. And by local GU community, I mean the community where the measures or the harm reduction programs are implemented. Harm reduction is not for sale. What works in Belgium does not necessarily work in Russia or elsewhere. Each community has its own problems that cause harms to both the local drug users and the local public. Therefore, if we want to implement real harm reduction programs, the first step should be go deep down in the community and check what is needed. That's why we insist on nothing about us without us. And because no one actually listens to us, the people who use drugs, currently what we see in practice is. In Belgium, for instance, harm reduction is studied by criminologists. So far about Belgium and about harm reduction services in Belgium. The best arguments the professionals worldwide have pro-harm reduction is cost-effective. I really do not know how we, the drug user activists, should feel about cost-effective. Our peers, the previous generation of drug user activists, started what we nowadays call harm reduction with the sole goal to save lives. Back then, harm reduction belonged to our community, and its cost-effectiveness came along implicitly. Nowadays, when harm reduction is monopolized by harm reduction professionals, when millions are spent on harm reduction projects, some of which with questionable results, others named drug-free, and everything is so institutionalized that drug users have to remind constantly that the main harm here is caused inside our community and by our community. I do not know how to feel about the cost effectiveness of harm reduction. I also do not know how to feel about harm reduction itself if the people who do harm reduction today define it as, I quote, a concept with alternative approaches that aim to keep drug users alive, healthy and productive until drug treatment works or until they grow out of drug use. In any case, if our productiveness is calculated in the cost effectiveness, we don't like the cost effectiveness that much anymore. All around the world, drug users are stigmatized, discriminated, marginalized, and criminalized. We are also sick, isolated, homeless, detained in concentration camps. And we have to be productive. Under these conditions, we don't want to be productive. And when addressed like this, we don't want to cooperate. That's why today I changed the approach. Instead of explaining one more time why nothing about us without us, I'll put the focus on how. And if I quote all the time one and the same organization, it is not a point-to-point finger. If you allow me, I'll even not name the organization. As I said, I do not want to insult nobody. I just want to make it more clear what we drug user activists encounter daily. If I go to other websites of other acknowledged drug user organization partners, I'll encounter for sure the same attitude. The reason to quote one and the same organization is to leave no room for misinterpretation of what I say. I want to be absolutely clear that I do not make a compilation of the worst experience my peers and I ever had. For us, what you hear now is routine. So at the current stage of cooperation, we and our service providers have achieved, there are just a few other things I want to add before I finish. The most important is, do not do it without us. The practice shows that this don't work, and all mistake costs human lives. And if you want to do it in the right way, please do not forget to approach it in the right way, which means respect us as equal partners. My experience shows that the way we are approached is the main reason that makes the cooperation with drug user activists so difficult. To clarify respect and equal partnership, I have included three more points. Don't take drug user involvement for granted or obligatory for us. We also have our bills to pay. Pay us. I think here everything should be clear. We are far above the age of enthusiast teenage guys. We might believe in what we do, but we have to survive. Most of us have families to support. Our job is too exhausting to do it as a side hobby and meanwhile to make our living as full-time employees elsewhere. It just doesn't work like this. There's no such hobby activism. Being a drug user activism totally drains us, so having an airplane ticket and a hotel room for free from time to time is not good enough. Not that we are greedy, as I said, we have to survive to be available. Like it goes with drug free. First, keep us alive. Also, do not think that we are the beneficiaries. It's society who wins. Motivate us. Don't confuse payment with motivation. Being a drug user activist is neither easy, nor pleasant, nor a well-paid job. Sooner or later even, the most devoted of us start asking themselves why they have to take all that comes along with the job, if nothing seems to make a difference. Please reconsider what motivation we have to do what we are expected and why we should undertake anything. Try for a moment to look at it from our point of view. And once again, revise your approach and the offered motivation. Take into consideration our personality and individuality. We are activists. Here we come again to the main issue we have, respect. If there was respect in our relations, everything else I said about payment motivation would be unnecessary details. If our professionals really respected us, they would never address us in the way they do it now. Happily, although exceptions, we have real partners. I just wish that our real partners become a majority. What else can I say? If this is a session about the new frontiers of harm reduction and I'm supposed to speak on nothing about us without us, probably I have to make a comment on our drug user view on the new frontiers. But before appointing new frontiers, let's see where we stand now. Opiates. At the international level, we have to promote the best practices worldwide. Local level, advocate for more harm reduction programs that address the needs of local drug user community. Free, affordable, equal access to these programs. cocaine and all other stimulants, amphetamine-type stimulants. Start from the very beginning, research, and again, implement harm reduction programs based on the needs. This means needs assessment, not political decisions based on judgmental moralism or moralistic judgment. We do not need moralism. A little bit pragmatism will do better. And of course, under the conditions of prohibition, there will always be a black market of illegal substances that are potentially harmful. Harm reduction is not a constant, it's a dynamic variable. The need for harm reduction services does not end with concrete substances. There will always be new drugs, new research will always be needed, and new drug user activists who can tell you the best how to deal with these new drugs. So, if you, our professionals, prioritize what I just summarized up to now, harm reduction will be brought back to the right perspective from the times of its starting point. This would be one good new frontier. For us drug user activists, we will keep on insisting for more and better harm reduction services, but we already put our new frontiers a little bit ahead. Through the approach of harm reduction, we can address only the violation of our fundamental human rights to health and proper medical services. Unfortunately, the zero-tolerance approach towards drug users had unforeseeable in scale and unimaginable in cruelty practical results. There are places where nowadays the concentration camps are called treatment facilities. And unfortunately, we have our reason to think that the future policies will allow increased options for health approach coming along with increased possibilities for repressions. So, we'll never turn our back on harm reduction, but our new frontiers will be the approach of human rights in general. We have 30 fundamental human rights. In one way or another, all of them are violated by the interpretations and the practical implementation of the UN drug conventions. We'll use all possible legal means to stop the massive abuse of drug users' human rights worldwide. Thank you.
Well, and finally, I'm glad to introduce our last panelist, Graciela Touce. She's going to talk about HIV and non-injecting drug use in Latin America. She is the president of Intercambios, an organization concerned with drug problems in Argentina. She argues for a harm reduction approach and respect for the dignity of drug users.
Thank you. Buenas tardes a todos y a todas. Good afternoon. I'm honored to be part of this panel, and so thank you to the organizers. According to the World Bank Annual Report 2007, rates of inequality in Latin America are among the highest in the world, with the richest 10% of the population holding 41% of total income, and the poorest 10% owning just 1%. Poverty reduction has stagnated, with 47 million people in the region, more than 8% of the population, still living in extreme poverty. UNAIDS estimated that as of December 2007, 1.6 million people were living with HIV in Latin America. Cocaine use is widely spread in Latin America. According to UNODC 2008 World Report, its use has increased in most of the countries in the region. Different patterns of injected, inhaled, and smoked cocaine use related to HIV have been studied in some South American countries since 2002. In Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay, injecting practice is more widespread than in other Latin American countries. Mexico has reported the importance of IDU at the Mexico-United States border. Colombia has also been reporting injection drug use. Cocaine is the most common substance injected throughout the region. Heroin is used in northern Mexico, particularly concentrated in the border cities of Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana, and to a lesser extent in Colombia, but is not widely used elsewhere in Latin America. Injecting drug use is associated with HIV infections in Argentina, Brazil, northern Mexico, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Studies with injectors show that many of them are socially networked with non-injectors. Only recently, however, is there evidence of the HIV seroprevalence among non-injecting drug users, which is higher compared to the HIV rates among the general population. As an example, these six studies conducted in Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay confirm the concerning findings of high HIV seroprevalence among non-injecting drug users, ranging from 1.6% to 9.5%. Cocaine is inhaled or smoked all over the region. Crack cocaine has expanded its use in several Brazilian cities. The use of coca past, called bazuco in Colombia, paco in Argentina, also used in Bolivia, Chile, Ecuador, and Peru, has increased in Argentina and Uruguay since the late 90s. The role of crack and its close relationship to the sex trade has contributed to the spread of HIV through heterosexual transmission in many Brazilian cities. HIV seroprevalence found among non-injecting cocaine users in Buenos Aires and Montevideo with rates of 6.3% and 9.5% might be suggesting the important role of sexual transmission among drug users and their sex partners. The high sero incidence rates detected among non-injecting cocaine users in Buenos Aires and Montevideo could imply that these cities are facing the emergence of a larger heterosexually driven epidemic. While a lack of comparable data makes it difficult to assess the full epidemiological impact of non-injecting cocaine use in Latin America, existing research suggests that it is an important driver in HIV epidemics. It is widely acknowledged that further research is needed on this topic in order to build evidence-based policies addressed to this population. The harms and risks associated with non-injecting drug use have seldom been targeted by integrated harm reduction initiatives in Latin America. While there are examples of good practice at the grassroots level, they are not yet integral components of comprehensive harm reduction package. It is also necessary to focus on social vulnerability of drug users, including social structural inequalities, as well as policies and institutional practice. In Latin American context, defined by huge social inequality, income disparity, and poverty, drug users' vulnerability is also related to frequent incarceration, violence, stigma, and drug policies and responses. HIV and harm reduction policies and practice need to be expanded to include non-injecting drug use, especially cocaine, and to address the untoward consequence of dire poverty, discrimination, and criminalization. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Graciela, and thanks to all of our speakers for giving us an awful lot to think about and for giving us some time for questions and discussion. There are microphones in the middle here, and we can take questions to individual members of the panel or to the panel as a whole. And please keep your questions short, and again, no adverts and no speeches. So please line up behind the microphones, and I'd like to take several questions at a time, if possible. Sam, you have a
question for each of the panelists. As a researcher, and in a sense representing many researchers here, tell us how we can help you, please.
Okay, who wants to start?
I'm a speed user, so I use amphetamine. And apart from abstinence, there's no treatment for us. So we'd like to see researchers going after harm reduction treatment, supportive harm reduction medication for people who use cocaine and amphetamine-type stimulants. I myself, I have my amphetamine on prescription. I couldn't get it because of dependency, because it's prohibited to prescribe for that. So I had to walk around it and pretend to have, although I have probably, attention deficit, because this is a reason to be able to prescribe amphetamine. But if you ask us what can the researchers do for us, look at cocaine and amphetamine, and you know that harm reduction is nowhere on this moment.
Okay. Graciela?
Well, as a harm reduction, as a Latin American harm reduction activist and as a Latin American researcher, and Sam, you know this very well, and you has helped and helps us a lot. I think what we need is from researchers from developed countries to listen, to pay attention, to take care of our local needs, and to take our agenda in the research projects, and not to push the own agendas of the main research centers. Thank you.
If I'm going to say something briefly, though interestingly, I am also a researcher. But like Sam will probably know, because I think he's worked in Africa, the enormous problems we're having on the continent with research funding. And I don't know who to blame for this, but you know, many times when I talk to people, it looks like a vicious cycle. When you approach funding agencies, they ask for evidence, but you can't get any evidence without research. So when we're talking about harm reduction in Nigeria, the best we still refer to is Adeleke's work in 2001 or 2002, because somehow he was able to manage to get some funding. And same goes for many countries in the subcontinent. But you can't approach any funder without evidence, but you can have evidence until somebody bells the cat. So what I would suggest is somebody's got to bell the cat. It may actually start with just a small seed grant to do a sentinel survey or something small, and then we can keep building on that. But now we can't actually really affect policy by evidence-based research, because there's so little of that's taking place in Africa.
I would echo what Landray and Stein just said. On both points, we need more research on drugs that aren't heroin, and particularly with their relationship to young people. And we also, like Landray said, one of the things that we really struggle with is that there's just not a lot of data on young people who use drugs, young people who inject drugs. A lot of the information that is out there isn't disaggregated by age, and we really need that. And there's not a lot of evidence. So we know what works. We can say as young people, you know, involve us, include us. We know what kind of programs work, but we get the same thing. Well, show us, prove us, prove to us that it works. Show us examples of where this has been evaluated. Show us where there really is this big problem with young people. And something I didn't mention earlier was that a lot of services that do provide services to underage youth won't report on them. They won't say that there's people under the age of 18 accessing their services because they don't want to get in trouble with their funders. So we really need support bringing this, the variety of different issues that young people face forward, and really having evidence that shows that these issues exist, that both by age and around different drugs as well, and strategies to work around those issues.
I guess two things from my perspective. First, again, support what Caitlin just said in terms of research that's really detailed in terms of disaggregated data. Professor Paul Hunt, who was the previous Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, did a really excellent paper during his tenure in which he articulated sort of a structure by which very good disaggregated health data could be used almost objectively to measure the degree to which states were meeting their obligations under the right to health. Because if you have good disaggregated data, you can measure over time the health of different populations. And Professor Hunt argued that this would actually be, in human rights terms, a very powerful, almost scientific tool to measure the degree to which states are fulfilling or not the right to health. The other thing, and I know Sam has done research on this himself, is the impact of repressive law enforcement on a variety of issues, not only on health status and access to harm reduction services, but also more generally in terms of some of the issues Stein brought up in terms of specific human rights abuses, but actually looking at repressive and harsh law enforcement frameworks and approaches themselves as social frameworks and legal frameworks that serve to make health worse and produce human rights violations.
My name is Tripti. I'm with the Lawyers Collective in India. I have a comment and a couple of questions. Thank you to the drug user activists for sharing your thoughts. I think it's amazing. And it just, you know, from yesterday, it, with all due respect, it was a physician who delivered the plenary and not somebody from the community. And we hope that it'll be different the next time round. Thank you very much. A couple of questions on the Young People's Network. I was just wondering if you guys have taken up the issue of drug testing in schools and colleges, which is pretty much a hot topic in North America, but may also be picking up in countries in Asia where we've started to see legislation around that. Secondly, in most drug laws, offering or administering drugs to an underage person, somebody below 18, is a very serious offense. So I wonder if you've, you know, like looked at that vis-a-vis harm reduction and delivery of services, especially substitution, etc., to young people. And thirdly, anything on, say, you know, given that drug use and possession is an offense across all jurisdictions, how, you know, how do juvenile justice systems and, you know, young people in prison on account of drug use or possession, have you got a hang on that?
Thank you very much for three very interesting questions. I'll ask Caitlin to start, but I'm sure that other members of the panel also have some response to those questions. So, Caitlin.
Thank you. So first, the question of drug testing. We've actually received quite a few questions in the past. We've done a few sessions at this conference and at the Youth Pre-Conference around school-based initiatives, whether they're positive, sort of reality-based education and what we're doing to support that. And then the opposite would be, I think many of us can agree, drug testing students as a form of prevention. And I mean, one of the things that I guess I should say, too, and that I'm really glad that Stein did the presentation he did, is that we're, like, this issue is so huge and so multifaceted, and we're so small and so underfinanced, that there's so, as soon as we sort of announced that this is what we wanted to do with the Youth Harm Reduction Network, it's been really overwhelming. So specifically, have we been able to do any work on drug testing? No. But a good example of where our advocacy, I think, has sort of countered some of the United States exporting of their drug testing policy is at the Vienna NGO Forum Beyond 2008, where, as young people, there was four of us there, and the contingent of conservative activists from the United States were very much pushing prevention, abstinence only, drug testing, and those sorts of things as a means for working with young people. And we were there to advocate for the opposite, to advocate for reality-based education, for support, for safe spaces for young people, for resources, for things like that. So what we've been able to do specifically on that issue is limited, although it's a really important one. And I think an issue that we all need to be aware of is where certain drug policies, particularly ones that affect young people, are being exported to. And drug testing is definitely one that's being pushed into other parts of the world by the United States. In terms of substitution therapy, I think that that's something that our network really needs guidance on. And this is where partnerships and mentorships relationships and working with physicians and working with experts in the field is really, really important. I'm not a doctor. I don't know. I know, and again, actually, the question of research, I know that there's not a lot of research done on young people and the effects of substitution therapy drugs on young people. And so this is an area that needs to be looked at. And I think that there are a lot of really valid questions about the applicability for substitution therapy for young people. And I think some of the policies that are in place are well-intentioned. I think that sometimes they can be restrictive and have negative consequences as well for young people. But I think for us, we're just saying this is an issue that needs to be addressed because of the growing or the younger age that young people are using injection drugs, or using opiates and injection drugs. And so we would definitely love to partner or look for some guidance around that issue. The issue of juvenile justice is also really huge. As I mentioned in my presentation, in most places around the world, there's prevention for drugs and then nothing else. And unfortunately, what happens is then young people are criminalized, particularly young people who are using drugs and kicked out of school, young people who don't have places to go in their communities. A lot of times young people are criminalized just for being on the streets, just for trying to survive, just for hanging out. And this is a really big issue. And so I think that the criminalization of young people, particularly young drug users, is something that we'd really like to pay attention to, and it ties into the question around human rights. And you can't separate them out, and that was a big topic in our last skills building workshop we did, is that harm reduction for young people it has to be holistic. It also has to be about safe spaces for young people to be. It also has to be about safe and affordable housing. It also has to be about income. It has to be about getting young people out of poverty, because a lot of people are involved in either their sex work or trafficking or just little petty whatever criminal activities so that they can survive because they're living in poverty. So these issues are very interconnected, and we don't want by any means for it to seem like we're working in isolation. We definitely think that harm reduction for young people has to be inclusive of all of these different aspects of their health and of their rights.
Thank you very much, Caitlin. Do other members of the panel wish to comment on those three questions or any of those three questions? Okay. Any more questions from the audience? I don't see. Yes, please.
I just was wondering, what would motivate you? What will motivate you? Okay. Stein said, we need more than money. We need motivation. What will motivate you?
I'd like to hear an answer to that from each of you. So let's start right at the end and work along the panel. Graciela, what will motivate you?
What motivates me? I think what motivates me is, working with people who is really far from being able to be in places like this, who lives in a small neighborhood, who never goes out of the neighborhood, who is whose world is sometimes so small, and to expand people's world, to expand people's opportunities, I think this is very motivating for me. And of course, to work in issues, in drug issues, that shows that it's also possible to work in an issue which shows a lot of social contradictions and inequalities, and working in these kind of issues is motivating for me.
It's a tough question and a hard one. Stein, I think you kind of got us into this issue about motivation.
The acknowledgement of people who use drugs by all the partners involved in our issue would already motivate a bit, but also to be treated as grown-ups and not as kids. and also the acknowledgement of the knowledge that we have and that people who don't use drugs don't have, and that, yeah, in the respect we deserve as people, these kind of things.
Thank you. Lanre.
Well, I would actually be motivated if truly people can actually take the harm reduction message past just tokenizing, just trying to just do something in Africa, but that real collaboration will really be established with people. Like I said, there are a lot of people on the ground who have a lot of experience in research that can actually, we can harness that. So I would really be motivated if more people will stand up and look for people to work with in different countries on the subcontinent.
Caitlin.
I think, again, I can echo what Stein said. It's true for us as young activists as well. I think also increased access for young people, the recognition that it takes a lot of time, commitment, support, and money to get the young people who really need to be involved and included to the table. It's not an easy thing to do. And that's why we get representation of certain groups of young people, but not of others, not young drug users, not street-involved children and youth. And they're not ever given the opportunity to speak for themselves. I think also real change and real recognition. I feel like a bit of a broken record for the past couple of years, and I actually don't really see what I'm saying being reflected. And I was really grateful to Stein for his presentation, because I think as young people, our issues are different sometimes, but they're also everybody's issues. And, you know, their gender issues, their human rights issues, their regional issues, their issues around certain drugs, their user issues. And, you know, it's not all about conferences, but a good example would be the fact that the International Harm Reduction Conferences, you know, this is really great. I'm really grateful to be on this panel, but this is very rare that a young person gets invited to speak on a panel that's not about young people. And I think we need the recognition that young people fit into lots of other issues, and we have a right to be at the table on plenary sessions that are talking about other issues, but gender, for example, as it relates to a young person, or criminalization as it relates to a young person, or whatever that is. And I don't see that being reflected yet. So I think, like Stein said, there's the talk about inclusion, but the real inclusion isn't happening yet. And honestly, funding motivates me. And I think that our network, in order for us to be sustainable, is that we do need money and we need long-term partnerships. And I'm concerned about the sustainability of the work that we're doing, because I don't know where that's available right now. So I think recognition motivates, and seeing real change motivates, and also funding motivates.
Okay, thank you. And finally, Rick, what motivates you?
I just like sticking it to the man.
Sticking it to the man. Good. Okay, your question, please.
Nice. I'll try and keep it short. There was mention of gateway drugs, and I think a lot of us in healthcare and in working in harm reduction, we look at drugs as kind of hierarchical. And when we're looking at, say, tobacco and alcohol, which probably cause the most death and most harm in many countries and in many regions, but we put those kind of lower, and we maybe say that they're gateway drugs to, say, marijuana or to injection or to smoking, kind of different drugs. So I'm just wondering if the panel can comment on what their thoughts are on, you know, as in one drug is worse than another drug, and is that more related to the prohibition of some drugs and the legalness of some drugs? It is a problem for people in the business of harm reduction when we say, well, you should just smoke crack instead of injecting it, so those types of things. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on kind of the drugs and that type of thing.
Okay, who'd like to start on that one? Lanre?
I like to start up because I guess it was during the course of my presentation that I just talk about gateway drugs. I believe we should be clear about it. It's not like we're trying to put drugs on a scale. It's not about that. But I was just talking in the context of Africa and Nigeria in particular, that a lot of people actually start off with tobacco, alcohol, and then they go to other things. But like I said, no, that's not the story for everyone. So for some people, they kind of like just start maybe to get to a party and they have amphetamines or, you know, LSD or something else. But when we're actually adopting harm reduction policies on the subcontinent or in Africa in general, we must remember that it should cover the whole spectrum of things that could cause harm and not necessarily maybe injecting drug or non-injecting drug, but everything that could actually cause harm one way or the other should actually be addressed. So it's actually a very comprehensive look at the things that actually cause harm. I don't know if somebody else wants to say something.
Gateway drugs puts drugs in an isolated position. And of course, we're all human beings living in an environment where things are not or are available. I remember when I was a kid, I've always been interested in drug use. Even when I was very small, we peeled bananas, and then these little threads that you could take from them, we thought if you dry them and smoke them that you would get high from it, you know. Well, it wasn't that tasty, and we didn't get that high. But also, I started smoking when I was 8, you know. I was just interested in this kind of stuff. And even if it wasn't tobacco, then probably it would have been something else.
Okay. I think, we'd all agree that any drug has the potential to be used in a harmful way or a non-harmful way, depending on the individual. I know before I came into policy work, I used to be a frontline harm reduction worker and counselor, primarily with prisoners and ex-prisoners. And my approach to harm reduction was always allow people to define their own harms that they want to try to minimize. So, for example, when I was working with ex-prisoners, most of them living with HIV, most of them living with Hep C, but for most of them, when they were out of prison, the number one harm they wanted to avoid was going back to prison. And so that's what we sort of talk about in terms of their drug use. Obviously, you know, we would talk about whatever issues, but for me, it was always central to allow people to define for themselves and not have me come in with my AIDS worker agenda that this is the number one issue that you should be concerned about because this is what I have to report back to my funder at Health Canada. It's more about letting people decide what it was for themselves and how can we as a support agency help to provide some tools to do that.
Yeah, I think that it's really individual and regional as well. Like for myself, I miraculously never did really smoke cigarettes, but I did a lot of other things. So my experience was maybe, different than other young people's. And I think that what it comes down to more so than, but is like Landre said, is it's really regional. And especially with young people, you know, alcohol and tobacco are not as stigmatized. And I think that, I don't know if there's any research about this, it'd be interesting to see if there is, just about what the sort of social acceptability or the stigma around certain substances are and the impact of that on then what, you know, might attract some people to it or might deter some people from using it. And, you know, I have friends who are cigarette smokers now who talk about in certain areas how stigmatized they feel as cigarette smokers, you know, and they're like, oh, I feel like I know a little bit what it feels like to be a drug user of illicit drugs. And so I think that it really varies depending on the region. And I think also the question for young people in harm reduction is an interesting one as it relates to alcohol and tobacco. And in terms of our network, what we've tried to focus on, because for example, tobacco is something we heard from a lot of young people in Africa. So I don't know what it is about youth in that region, but they're thinking about tobacco and concerned about tobacco. And we hear about it a lot, and alcohol and marijuana a lot, and in the Caribbean too, around alcohol and marijuana. But in other regions, that's not what young people are as concerned about. So it might have a lot to do with also cultural perceptions around certain substances and things like that. So I think that it's a really regional question also. Yeah, and I'm interested in it. If anybody knows of any research on the sort of connection between the social acceptability of certain substances and how that relates to young people's perceptions of them.
Graciela, did you want to comment?
Yes, of course I agree with the need of having a comprehensive approach to the use of different substances, never mind the legal status of the substance. But I think that what we must not forget is that we need to face the consequence of the use of different substances, but that we must be especially concerned on the consequence of the social responses to this use. And the social responses to the use of legal substances are really different from the social responses of illicit drug use. And I think that the harms we are finding in these social responses are harms that we need to face in a very strong way if we want to go on.
Well, in closing, I would like to thank you all for being here and thank our panelists for this great job. Have a good day.